MechCast, Wednesday, August 31st, 2016. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, another week's gone by. We're actually here at the end of the month, recording on the last day of August. How was your summer? Mine was a little bit crazy. I'm actually kind of looking forward to the fall, to things maybe hopefully calming down again, although they never seem to really calm down, especially in the world of podcasting and talking about Apple stuff, because there's always things going on. And actually, the fall is that time of year when Apple goes nuts. Yeah, we're prepping for an Apple event. We're going to talk about that in this episode. Also talk about maybe what's next and when is the next event happening. And it's probably sooner than you might think. We've got some rumors already of what's going to be going on with Apple products in the next year, in 2017. A little kerfuffle with the record labels and Apple Music. They're not so happy about some of the deals Apple is making with artists, and we'll comment a little bit on that. Also, going to get into what Apple's been up to in the field of artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning. There was a great article that was posted this week by Stephen Levy that I want to talk to you about a little bit. Does your iPhone have touch disease? And also a critical security update for iOS 9. So we've got all of that in the news and some great feedback from you. Actually, some follow-ups from the last show. I've got your comments on what you want to see in Apple's new products. And actually, I was surprised by some of your comments there. And then I'm going to talk about monitoring cellular data usage on iOS. And I have my thing of the moment. So feature-packed episode for you this week. Stay tuned for that in just a moment. But before we get started, I do want to take a minute and thank one of my show sponsors. And that is iMazing. Actually, this is an incredibly powerful tool that lets you access, view, backup, and manage the data on your iOS devices. And while you can do a lot of those things in iTunes, iMazing makes it so much better and so much more powerful. You can actually get at some of the data and some of the information that you're not going to be able to get at directly with iTunes. And best of all, there's no jailbreaking required. So what kinds of things can it do? Well, it can actually allow you to manage and interact with data from your messages, your photos and videos, Apple Music app. You can get into notes, contacts. You can access your voicemails and actually back those up. You can access your call history, back that up as well. You can get into the file system. And not only that, you can get at all of this information directly on your iOS device or even from your backups. And iMazing will actually allow you to make backups as well. It has a very familiar Apple-like interface. It's kind of got that three-panel iTunes style interface that we're used to, and it works really fast. And best of all, you can work asynchronously. So if you're running a backup or maybe you're pulling off a bunch of voicemails or something like that, you can start that in the background and then do other things within the iMazing app. And I think I mentioned in the last episode that one of the things I use iMazing for is actually migrating and moving Minecraft Pocket Edition maps. My kids are really into that. They're constantly creating maps and they want to get a map from one iOS device to another. And after I mentioned that, several of you emailed to say, Adam, that's really cool. I'd like to use iMazing to do that, but how do you do that? Well, I went ahead and put together a video for you guys. I posted it up on the Facebook page. I put it on MacCast.com. I put it on the Google Plus community. You can also find it on my YouTube channel, but if you want to check that out, go to MacCast.com and you can see exactly how you use iMazing to actually move those things around. And best of all, you can try iMazing completely free, and actually you can do the Minecraft stuff with just the free version. But when you're ready to order, they're giving MacCast listeners 20% off. So just use the coupon code MacCast, M-A-C-C-A-S-T, at checkout over at iMazing.com, and you're going to get 20% off iMazing. It's a really great app. It's just one of those great tools to have in your Mac arsenal. And a big thank you to iMazing for their support of the show. So we have an official date for Apple's September event for the next iPhone event. It's going to be on September 7th. Apple sent out invites this past week, and the press are scheduling their trips. It's going to be at the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium in San Francisco. Things are going to kick off at about 10 a.m. Well, exactly at 10 a.m. Pacific time. Apple's pretty good about being on time. And the whole thing is going to be streamed online. So I'm going to be hanging out. Probably will fire up the MacCast chat room. So head to MacCast.com on that day. You can get all the details. We have an IRC chat going on. I'm sure it's very likely that the folks over at the British Tech Network, the Mac Show, will be doing something as well. And I might be participating in that. So stay tuned. Follow me on Twitter and I'll try and post when that is happening. But Apple is calling this event the See You on the 7th event. Yeah, not very original this time around. Certainly, it's expected to be totally iPhone focused. As far as what the latest predictions are, I know you've heard a lot of these already, but we're kind of narrowing in on what the final specs might be. Still expecting a solid-state, pressure-sensitive Force Touch ID home button. So no longer the mechanical clickable home button, but something using the Force Touch technology. Apple's expected to update the processor to a new A10 processor along with an M10 motion coprocessor. The iPhone 7 is expected to get 2 gigabytes of RAM, and you're going to get 3 gigabytes in the iPhone 7 Plus. I should mention that it's expected that the sizes are going to remain the same, 4.7 inches for the iPhone 7 and the 5.5 inch on the iPhone 7 Plus. Battery is expected to be bumped up a little bit, 1960 milliamp hours on the iPhone 7, 2910 milliamp hours on the iPhone 7 Plus. And I think the biggest upgrade is going to be the camera system. A 12 megapixel camera on the iPhone 7. I still believe that it's going to finally add optical image stabilization to the iPhone model. And on the Plus model, you're going to get that new dual lens system. And both of those are expected to be 12 megapixel sensors on the dual lens system. No headphone jack. One leak supposedly of what the in-the-box components are. There was an image that surfaced this week. Seems to show that it will have not only lightning earpods, which is sort of what I thought it would have, but that also Apple will include the lightning headphone adapter. I thought that was going to be sold as a separate accessory. My rationale for that was I didn't think that Apple wanted to admit that you would require any kind of adapter by putting it in the box. But it sounds like it's going to be in there. That should ease the transition for a lot of people who maybe have 3.5 millimeter headphones that they really like and they don't want to give up. So they're going to put that in the box for you. And there was a filing that showed up with the Eurasian Economic Commission that listed wireless headphone AirPods as an Apple kind of trademark. So there may still be some hope that Apple might have a wireless version of the EarPods ready to go. Whether or not it'll be at launch or whether it'll be sometime in the future, who knows? But I would imagine that to be a higher-end add-on accessory. It's also expected that Apple will dump the 16-gigabyte version on the lower end and have the entry-level models come with 32 gigabytes. And then you'll have a 128-gigabyte and a 256-gigabyte size option. And it does seem at this point like it's going to be that way across both lines, both the iPhone 7 and the iPhone 7 Plus. There's still some debate over what the color choices might be. I think it's safe to assume space gray, gold, and rose gold, although we've had these rumors that Apple might be moving to a space black color. And then this week, an image showed up that supposedly showed a SIM cover in a glossy black as well as a space black. And the glossy black they were kind of comparing to like the Mac Pro. I think that would look great. I'm still kind of hoping they might that one rumor about the space blue, the kind of dark blue color, might be true, although I'm not putting much faith in that. I give that about a 10% chance. I really think that Apple's probably going to land on space black, gold, and rose gold. I think those are going to be the three colors that we see. But we're going to have to wait until next week on Wednesday to find out for sure. And now that the announcements are out, of course, you can take what was on the invitation and ask Siri about it. So you can say, Siri, see you on the 7th. And she is providing a number of very witty responses. It's kind of a fun game to play around with. So you can try that out on your iPhone. My favorite so far is be there or be heptagonal. Yep, seven-sided. So that's Siri for you. And, you know, as far as predictions on is the iPhone 7 going to kind of stop the slowing in iPhone sales? Well, Gene Munster thinks that Apple currently has about 275 million iPhone users that are on devices that are more than 2 years old. So that would seem like it's a pretty large base who might be ready to upgrade to an iPhone 7, a nice potential. But because of the lack of any real major new changes or design features, it's not really clear if that's going to be enough to lure upgraders. If you're in that camp, I'd be curious to know, you know, are you a person with a 2-year-old or older iPhone? And how do you feel about the iPhone 7? Actually, maybe you want to wait till next week to tell me. But if you have some thoughts on it now, are you excited about what you've heard from the rumors? Is this enough to get you to upgrade? I'd be curious to know. General consensus is that it might not be enough. So Munster thinks that it's going to take more radical design changes, some of those that are probably coming in 2017. We're going to talk about those here in a minute. That could do the trick. Overall, he's predicting that Apple may sell about 234.5 million iPhones in the fiscal year of 2017, with about 150 million of those being the new flagship iPhone 7. So if you break those numbers out, you can see he's predicting that more of the sales are going to come later in 2017 when Apple announces a new radically redesigned version of the iPhone. And we don't know if that's going to be an iPhone 8 or an iPhone 7S, although most predictions are thinking that Apple's going to stop the S cycle and simply go from iPhone 7, iPhone 8, iPhone 9 from this point forward. And I would generally kind of agree with that thought process. And then, of course, it would not be an iPhone launch without rumors of supply chain shortages and the fact that we're going to have a hard time getting our hands on the exact iPhone that we want. Nikkei is reporting this week that the iPhone 7 is and could face supply issues at launch. They're saying a couple of components are the main culprits. That new dual lens camera sensor for the iPhone 7 Plus. We'd been hearing that Apple had been struggling with that for a while, so that really wasn't surprising. But they're also saying that Apple is experiencing some defects in a new waterproof speaker. Another one of the big improvements that's supposedly coming with the iPhone 7 is better waterproofing. That's one of the reasons why Apple is supposedly getting rid of the headphone jack and going with the solid state home button to kind of seal things up a little bit more in the iPhone. And I guess the speaker, new waterproof design, is giving Apple a little bit of trouble. So that may end up causing some supply chain shortages at launch. There's also reports that Apple in general has been ordering fewer units to have ready at launch than they did for the iPhone 6S. And I would say that the iPhone 7 is actually going to have more demand than the 6S did. So if Apple is producing fewer units at launch and demand is a little bit higher, then you could expect maybe some supply chain shortages. But Apple always seems to recover from supply constraints pretty quickly. And I'd expect this launch to go no differently. So I'm not super worried about it. But I will see you online at midnight, you know, frantically refreshing my browser and pulling up the Apple Store app, trying to get my order in on day one so that I don't get impacted by those supply shortages. So good luck to you, and we'll see you online once we know the official date. But it's sort of expected that if Apple is going to hold the announcement event on the 7th, that pre-orders would come in on the 9th. And I think most people are predicting a delivery date of September 23rd. Although it could be the next week, the 16th. Apple has done it both ways, where they've made an announcement, taken pre-orders that same week, and then either launched the next week or 2 weeks later. I'm going to hedge my bets and put the date at the 23rd for the actual release of the iPhone. That's what I think is going to happen this time around. But we're going to have to wait and see. Luckily, we only have to wait one more week, and then we'll know all the exact details. Another question surrounding this event is, will we see an Apple Watch 2 at this event? Personally, I give it a 50-50 chance. It could be coming later in October, but signs seem to be pointing to an Apple Watch update relatively soon. And that was a little bit surprising to me. I thought Apple might hold off until early 2017. But if we do see an Apple Watch at this event or in October, what will we see? Well, this week some images surfaced of a purported battery pack that would increase the capacity to 334 milliamp hours. The current 42 millimeter version of the Apple Watch has a 245 milliamp hour battery, so that would actually be a nice jump up and could potentially mean an improvement of a couple hours of extra battery life. But you have to remember that another one of the rumors is that Apple may add a GPS unit to the Apple Watch 2, so that extra battery life could get eaten up just by the GPS. And you may also remember that the Wall Street Journal reported that there could be cellular modem capabilities in there, although Bloomberg kind of shot that down, saying that Apple ran into battery concerns and some other technological limitations that caused them to delay the cellular-enabled features for a future Apple Watch. So that may not make it into the Apple Watch 2. As a matter of fact, I'm going to put my predictions on GPS and no cellular data. A lot of people really want to see an Apple Watch that would be totally autonomous, not tied into the iPhone. But I don't really find that to be too much of an issue. While that would be a nice feature, I don't think it's something that most people would be willing to give up battery life for. And GPS is going to be a little bit more critical in terms of exercise tracking, getting more accurate distance tracking. So I think that's the right thing to add. If you had to choose between cellular modem and GPS capabilities in the next Apple Watch, I think Apple made the right call there. You may disagree. If you do, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But another thing expected for an Apple Watch 2 update is a new processor. Apple moving from the S1 chip that they use now to a new S2. The belief is that Apple's going to use a new 16 nanometer design for that chip that would be manufactured by TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. And that should allow for more energy efficiency. So that should help with the battery life, especially if Apple does put a GPS in there. For comparison, Apple currently uses a 28 nanometer design from Samsung. A few other features rumored for the next generation Apple Watch: a thinner, lighter display assembly, better waterproofing, possibly allowing for swim tracking, which I think a lot of people would really like in the exercise app, and maybe even Apple adding in a FaceTime camera, which I think would be an interesting enhancement and a nice thing to see. That would be a nice upgrade, and I think a lot of people would be really happy with that. Corning also announced this week that they have a new version of Gorilla Glass, something they're calling Gorilla Glass SR, SR Plus. The SR stands for scratch resistant, and they say it's ideal for smartwatch applications. Now, Apple currently uses Ion X glass, and I'm not 100% sure if that's Corning glass or not. I think it is. But on their higher end models, they went with sapphire glass, which is known for its scratch resistance. So the Gorilla Glass SR Plus is really being designed to kind of compete with the scratch resistance of sapphire. As a matter of fact, according to Corning, they say it offers scratch resistance similar to sapphire. They don't say it's the same, they say it's similar. But they note that Gorilla Glass has a 70% better damage resistance against impacts, and they say it also has 25% better surface reflection. So, you know, overall, they're kind of touting it as a better replacement, because the one disadvantage of Sapphire is it does tend to crack a little bit easier under impacts. And we've seen that with people dropping Apple Watches. So will Apple switch to the new Gorilla Glass? Who knows? They may stick with the Sapphire just for its kind of luxury properties. A lot of people, you know, Sapphire Glass is something that is used in high-end watches, and Apple may try to stick with, you know, the chronograph horography kind of marketing for the Apple Watch. And then finally, something else that seems to be pointing to the idea that Apple may update the Apple Watch soon is Best Buy this past week dropped the price on the 38mm Apple Watch Sport down to $199 US. So you can pick up one for $200. And it is expected that Apple, if Apple does update the Apple Watch, bring out an Apple Watch 2, that they may continue to sell the, at least the Sport model, as an entry-level model in version 1 of the Apple Watch at a reduced price point, probably right around $200. So that is some indication that Apple is going to update the Apple Watch. As far as if they will do it at this September event, I tend to think that they won't. I think they're going to wait until the October event to announce a new Apple Watch. I think really the entire September event is going to be focused on iPhone, although Apple could surprise us. So we're just going to have to wait and see. So what about new Macs? Are those coming? Well, that is what I expect Apple to do in October. We've seen them do this in the past where they have an iPhone event followed almost immediately the next month by a Mac event. And there are hints in macOS Sierra of new Macs coming, potentially with support for USB 3.1 Generation 2, which supports up to 10 gigabits per second in data transfer. It's being marketed as SuperSpeed Plus USB, not to be confused with SuperSpeed USB, which is USB 3.1 Generation 1, the stuff in the current MacBook models. Yeah, isn't USB great? It's just not confusing at all. So let me review that. USB 3.1 Generation 1, that was added to the current MacBook models. There's actually a faster version of that called USB 3.1 Generation 2, which is supposedly coming in new Macs. And part of the reason it would be coming in new Macs is because USB 3.1 Generation 2 will likely come via Thunderbolt 3, which does support that specification and also supports the USB-C connector, which is also supported by Thunderbolt 3. So Thunderbolt 3 can run over a USB-C connector and can support USB 3.1. So I think all of those things are going to come together, because Thunderbolt 3 brings support for data transfer rates of up to 40 gigabits per second and support for DisplayPort 1.2 along with power. So I think Apple's going to be standardizing all future notebook models on a USB-C connector, and I think they're going to want to bring Thunderbolt 3 support in, especially on the Pro models, but I think actually across the board. And that means you're going to be able to hook up 4K, 5K displays and do all this great stuff over a single standardized connector. And we've already heard rumors of an updated Retina MacBook Pro, something featuring this new LED touch-enabled function bar, which actually internally by Apple is reportedly called the Dynamic Function Row. It's going to be a LCD screen, a touch-sensitive LCD screen that is going to replace your function keys and allow different applications to actually, in software, change the functionality of those keys. So you can have customizable, programmable keys up there. It's also rumored that it's going to integrate the Touch ID sensor, so it'll be the first time that a Mac has support for Touch ID. And I think it's because in macOS Sierra and in Safari, they're going to be actually bringing Apple Pay to Safari. So the ability to authenticate and log in with your fingerprint on your MacBook Pro, I think, is something Apple, again, is going to want to do across the board. I'm expecting accessories and other things to bring Touch ID functionality to other Macs as well. So I would fully expect maybe some updates to the Apple Wireless Keyboard that integrate Touch ID, or maybe even into the trackpad, the Magic Trackpad, although I think it makes more sense for integration with the keyboard for other models of the Mac. As far as things beyond the MacBook Pro, well, we are hearing that Apple may be looking to refresh the iMac and MacBook Air, as well as possibly introduce a 5K display. This comes from Bloomberg. I'm kind of with them on the iMac. On the MacBook Air, I find that to be a little bit iffy. I think the MacBook Air is probably not going to be updated. I think the new MacBook models sort of fill the gap of that nicely. And also, as far as Apple doing a 5K display, doesn't it feel like that ship has sailed, that, you know, Apple is sort of out of the display business? There's a number of great 4K and 5K third-party displays. I'm not really sure that Apple needs to do that, although a lot of people really like Apple's design of displays and are looking forward to that. So maybe they're going to do that. Bloomberg certainly seems to think so. As far as what's going to be in these updates, they're saying the MacBook Air, mainly a processor bump, and then Apple would be standardizing on the USB-C ports. For the iMac, they don't give a lot of details beyond saying that Apple would integrate new GPUs from AMD, and there's actually some great new graphics processors from AMD, so that would be a nice addition to the iMac. Also, across the board, I think we would be expecting new processors. More on that and what those processors might be here in a minute. And as far as that 5K display goes, they say that Apple is partnering with LG Display, the same company they partnered with for the Retina iMac, the iMac 5K display. So imagine a 27-inch standalone 5K display from LG. And I would assume it would kind of integrate the controllers and possibly its own GPU to actually be able to support 5K. And we had heard that rumor a while back, so this may actually finally be happening, and we would expect the announcements to come in October. Bloomberg is also claiming that Apple's working on a new iPad Pro that would be ready in the first half of 2017. They again don't give many details other than saying it would have faster display technology. We also did have that rumor from last week that Apple possibly might be adding a new size, a 10.5-inch model. I think that would only serve to kind of confuse things, but a number of you wrote in to comment that you think what Apple may do is replace the 9.7-inch model with a 10.5-inch screen, but keeping the form factor about the same size, so really reducing the bezels on the 9.7-inch. And so you essentially have an iPad that would have the same resolution as the 12.9-inch iPad Pro, but in a smaller form factor, in the 10.5-inch size, and really physically dimension-wise, more in the size of a 9.7-inch, which could be really interesting, and that actually could simplify things for developers if those resolutions were the same. My concern was in adding a third model, so having a 9.7, a 10.5, and a 12.9, that you'd have three different resolutions, and it just complicates things in ways that they really don't need to be complicated. But sticking with two models and just going with a bigger screen size, I can kind of buy into that. Now, getting back to those Macs, one thing that the Macs won't likely feature is Intel's latest Kaby Lake processors. Right now, the reason why I think those won't be included is that Intel is currently only shipping the ultra-low power versions of those chips, and they are the ones mainly destined for tablets and convertibles and things like that. They also are actually shipping some dual-core versions of those chips. Those are available in September, and I guess Apple could go with those. I think Apple uses dual cores in the 13-inch Retina models, but the H series of the Kaby Lake processors, the quad-core units, won't be shipping until later in 2017. And so that means Apple could release these new models with the almost year-old now Skylake processors, but I don't think that's going to be that big of a deal. Intel calls these Kaby Lake processors 14-nanometer plus processors. They are a slight improvement over the current generation Skylake processors. They run at a little bit higher clock speed. They do have a much better integrated GPU. There's some significant improvements there. They can actually decode and encode 4K video on the integrated graphics processor in the Kaby Lake. But overall, they have about a roughly 15 to 20% boost in performance on average tasks like office documents and web browsing and stuff like that. So, you know, they're not, this isn't a screaming update by any sense of the word. So I think Apple's going to be okay going with Skylake. If they didn't, we'd be looking at them waiting until the first quarter, second quarter of 2017 to release Mac updates. And I just don't think they're going to wait that long. Desktop processors for in the Kaby Lake versions are also coming out in September. So it's going to seem like Apple's going to be kind of off cycle from Intel's release cycle. Although Intel is already working on their eighth generation processors. So maybe the next round of updates in 2017 could feature those processors. And finally, as far as Macs go, there was no word on any Mac Pro or Mac Mini updates yet. So who knows what's going on with those. The Mac Pro is severely, severely overdue for an update. So it'd be nice if Apple would do something on that end. If they don't at this October announcement do anything with the Mac Pro, I'm going to start assuming that basically Apple is getting out of the Pro market altogether and maybe going to try and market the iMac, the 27-inch iMac, as the solution for their Pro customers. I'm not so sure how well that's going to go over with a lot of Pros. But again, if they don't bring out a new Mac Pro in October along with the other Macs, I think that's pretty much it. The Mac Mini could continue along. Maybe we'll see a slight bump up in October just in terms of the processor, something Apple does quietly. I don't think they'll make any big fanfare or any big announcements about that. But they could. They have included the Mac Mini. They did in 2014 include that in the updates. So we'll just have to wait and see. But I fully expect all of that to happen sometime in October. And then rumors are already starting to fly for what's going to happen with the iPhone in 2017. Many outlets, mostly Bloomberg, seem to be indicating that this is the iPhone that will feature a radical redesign. They're saying it's going to be an edge-to-edge, flexible OLED display, possibly with curved edges. So no more top and bottom bezels. And that may get you thinking, well, hey, if they do that, what's going to happen to the home button and Touch ID? They're saying that the home button and Touch ID could be directly integrated into the display. And part of the reason for this is that Johnny Ive has had a long time desire to build an iPhone design that looked like a single sheet of glass. So this is the model that's expected to be glass front and back, really have kind of almost no metal. It's going to be wrapped around on the edges. And for 2017, they're predicting that Apple will finally include wireless charging, an enhanced haptic engine, and possibly new biometric capabilities like iris scanning and facial recognition. I'm not so sure how I feel about the iris scanning. The idea of sort of having to hold my iPhone up to my face to unlock it. I'm pretty happy with the Touch ID sensor. It seems convenient. It seems very natural to unlock your iPhone that way. I guess if they can have some sort of technology or camera that can recognize my face at odd angles so I don't have to hold the iPhone in a weird way, that could work for me. But what are the advantages of iris scanning or facial recognition over thumbprint scanning? Maybe in combination, all of that makes the device more secure. Or I guess, you know, one of the ideas is it would be faster. Literally, you could raise your iPhone and then boom, it could unlock it instantly just based on facial recognition. So I guess I could see the advantages there. But it just seems like one of these odd features, unless it's like totally perfect. And I guess I should know that Apple, if they're going to implement the feature, would do it perfectly. Then I guess it makes sense. As mentioned, Apple is also expected to move to OLED, but that transition could be brief. If you remember, Apple reportedly opened a secret laboratory in northern Taiwan that's been working on a technology called micro LEDs. This was actually after Apple acquired LuxView Technology in 2014, which was a company focused on micro LED technology. So it's sounding like OLED or OLED is destined to be replaced by micro LED technology. And that's because micro LED displays can be thinner and lighter, and they offer improved color gamut, as well as increased brightness and higher resolutions. So superior in many, many ways. The main issue at this point is that currently micro LED displays are very expensive and difficult to mass produce. But Apple is working on that technology. So maybe by the time they get around to doing a 2018 update of the iPhone, they may have already moved on from OLED, which would mean Apple only had one generation. Again, assuming the 2017-inch model is, or the 2017 iPhone model is going to feature an OLED display, it would be the only one that Apple ever had. And that's an interesting thing to think about. And then the other thing that's interesting to think about, and we kind of talked about this a little bit last week, is Intel becoming a chip supplier for Apple's iPhone. Right now, TSMC is reportedly, they reportedly have deals with Apple to be the sole supplier of chips for 2016 and 2017. So they're going to be supplying A10 and A10 or A11 chips. But Nikkei Asian Review thinks that Apple and Intel are already in talks for Intel to produce at least some of the A12 processors for Apple in 2018. And this comes on the back of a licensing deal between Intel and ARM that I talked about last week. But you may remember that that licensing deal is currently for some of ARM's new reference designs and likely doesn't cover Apple's heavily modified versions of the ARM technology. But still, the fact that Intel is working with ARM and that they have some licensing, that does mean that they could be vying to try and get some of Apple's business. And it does sound now that that is exactly what is going on. So both Intel and TSMC are working toward deploying 10 and 7 nanometer process technologies for developing processors. And those would be ideal for future mobile processors. So if Intel can get the licensing and can make a deal from with Apple, there's going to be some kind of big benefits to Apple to kind of locking up Intel as a potential future supplier for A-series processors. One is that they no longer have to rely on a competitor like Samsung for being a second supplier of chips. And also, some of the A-series production could actually move to the U.S., which would come off as a good PR win for Apple as well. So bringing that stuff over to Intel in 2018, I think it's something that Apple would be very interested in. The main irony of this whole story, though, is that Apple approached Intel, and you may or may not remember this, but Apple approached Intel about manufacturing chips for the original iPhone. And it was reported that Intel passed on that because they did not believe the iPhone was going to be popular enough to kind of generate the chip volume that they would want to have. And that just wouldn't be high enough. And obviously, in retrospect, they were way off on that. And they'd been struggling to actually get into the mobile business, to win over mobile business, until they kind of did this deal with ARM. So now that they're going to be able to produce ARM-based processors, I think they already have a deal in place with LG for some ARM-based processors. And if they can score a contract with Apple, I think that's going to be a big win for Intel, who's actually kind of seen their, you know, desktop and notebook business kind of slowing a little bit just because of slowing sales in general of those kinds of computers. You know, more people transitioning to using smartphones and tablets as supplements to desktops and notebooks. So the mix, people upgrading a little bit less frequently. Intel really needs to get a mobile solution going soon. And it sounds like they're kind of moving in the right direction for that. And Apple could be a big help for them moving forward. If you've been paying attention to Apple's music strategy or their sales strategy for getting new subscribers on Apple Music, then you probably know that doing music exclusives with artists for certain albums, for certain tracks and things like that has been a big part of how they're trying to lure customers to Apple Music. Well, some of those exclusive deals may be coming to an end because the executives over at Universal Music Group are not too happy about artists doing those exclusives. This week, Universal Music Group CEO Lucian Grange sent out a memo to all of his executives saying they are prohibiting them from doing any more exclusive music streaming deals moving forward. And the move kind of seems to be in direct response to Frank Ocean's new album, Blonde, which launched exclusively for 2 weeks on Apple Music, though that's not specifically mentioned in this note. I think over at Universal Group, Frank Ocean actually fulfilled a contract that he had with Universal Music by releasing the Visual album, which was also an Apple Music exclusive. And then this new Blonde album was something he had waiting in the wings that was totally self-produced. And Universal Music Group is not too happy about that. Now, to be fair, this ban does not just specifically target Apple and Apple Music. There's dozens of labels under Universal Music Group that aren't allowed to do deals, exclusive music deals, with any streaming provider. So that includes Spotify, Tidal, Pandora, as well as Apple and any of the others. Now, the immediate fallout of this letter was that Lady Gaga had her fifth studio album ready to go, and she's on Universal's label Interscope. So they were going to do an exclusive music, Apple Music deal for that launch. Obviously, that can't happen now. Now, the labels seem to want to stop this practice because they feel that, in general, it's going to hurt the music industry in the long run. Giving too much power to a single music service. Again, they're not singling out Apple, but the presumption is that Apple, with its sort of massive bankroll, they've been locking up a lot of these exclusives, and that could give Apple a slight edge over some of the other music services. And if Apple's subscriber base grows large enough, then that puts a lot of power in Apple's court when negotiating with the record labels. So I think they're overly concerned that these exclusive deals are going to sort of skew where people get their music subscriptions from. And if there's too much power in any one person's house, that's going to be ultimately a bad thing for the labels. Is it ultimately a bad thing for the artists? I think that could be up to date. But they also argue that it puts too much focus on top tier talent, kind of pushing out some of the smaller indie musicians who can't get the same deals. But I'd almost argue that the record labels do that themselves also in terms of how they promote certain artists and certain acts and things like that. The big guys kind of always get a lot of the focus. So the reality is that these deals do seem to draw in subscribers to specific music services. And I think they're also a pretty good deal for the artists. You know, Frank Ocean's self-released album exclusive on Apple did amazingly well for him, and probably generated a lot of revenue for him. So the larger subscriber base at Apple Music would, in my opinion, actually help all of the artists that have their music on Apple Music, because a lot of people are going to come to Apple Music, they're going to subscribe for the hits and those big exclusives, but then they're going to stay for the depth of the catalog, for the amazing discovery features that Apple Music provides. And I have found a bunch of new music artists by just listening to all of the big name artists that I like on Apple Music. And I think that's really what it's all about. And this move, I think, by the record labels personally could actually backfire. I think more artists are going to get fed up with the labels telling them what they can and can't do. Here they are telling them you can't do any exclusives that are really pretty lucrative for the artists with Apple. And I think that's really going to upset them. And when they get to the end of their contracts, they're going to really consider, do I want to renew or should I go it on my own? You know, kind of like Frank Ocean did. Should I self-publish, go direct to Apple, get some really great streaming services deal, pit the streaming services against each other for my content, get the best possible deal I can for my launch? And it's likely that, you know, that is going to be good for the artists. It might not be as great for consumers because it sort of fragments your choice, especially if you like a specific artist. You're going to have to kind of go with whatever music service they tend to move toward. But, you know, even there, that's not really that bad because most of these exclusives, if you haven't noticed, last for a week or two. So it's just that first week or two where you're going to have to follow, you know, which music streaming service they're on. But if you're willing to wait a little bit longer, then, you know, it's going to be across every streaming music service eventually. So I don't think you know, I think the record labels and some artists are making a bigger deal about these music exclusives than they really are. Although I could be wrong. I'm not an expert on the music industry. If you have a counter opinion to that and some evidence to kind of support it, shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. But I have a feeling that the exclusives are going to continue. It's just going to be that the labels are going to be cut out. And, you know, ultimately, I'm not so sure that's really a bad thing. Now, not long after the UMG report, the Universal Music Group reports surfaced from the New York Times and Bloomberg, they alleged that Spotify was punishing artists who agreed to Apple Music exclusives. Allegedly, Spotify had explicitly told artists who did Apple Music exclusives that their music wouldn't be included in featured playlists. And reports additionally claimed that Spotify buried their songs in search rankings. Now, a Spotify spokesperson said Bloomberg's claim that Spotify had buried search results for songs of artists who had signed Apple exclusives was unequivocally false. But what was interesting to me about that statement was it didn't address the allegation that Spotify told artists who did Apple Music exclusives that their music wouldn't be included in featured playlists. So I'm not entirely certain if that portion of the report was accurate or not, but Spotify is saying they are not punishing artists for doing Apple Music exclusives. And then one other thing in sort of Apple Music news, Apple announced the lineup for their Apple Music Festival. That's the thing that used to be called the iTunes Music Festival. It goes from September 18th through the 30th at the Roundhouse in London. And it's a series of concerts, and it features artists like Elton John, Britney Spears, Alicia Keys, One Republic, Calvin Harris, and Chance the Rapper, among others. And if you live nearby, you can actually apply for a lottery to win tickets to actually go to the shows in person. But Apple also live streams the event. This year, they're going to be live streaming 10 performances, but your access to it is a little bit different. In the past, it was available to anyone on iTunes. This year, it's looking like it's going to be exclusive for Apple Music subscribers to watch live. Now, I don't know if they're going to have recorded versions that will be available for others. It wasn't clear in kind of the reports that I was reading. It just said that it was going to be exclusive for Apple Music subscribers to watch the content live or to watch those 10 concerts live. Now, of course, you could always sign up for a free 3-month trial of Apple Music if you want to see those, if you haven't signed up for that trial already. I think if you've signed up for a trial in the past, you won't be able to sign up again, and you're going to have to pay for Apple Music if you want to see the iTunes Music Festival live. And I just realized I called it by its old name. It's the Apple Music Festival. So if you are up to date on your artificial intelligence, your machine learning, your deep learning, you may know that there are a lot of analysts and critics out there who are pretty critical of Apple in this area and saying Apple is really falling behind companies like Google and Amazon in terms of artificial intelligence assistants that use machine learning and deep learning to generate predictive algorithms and sort of anticipate our needs and things like that. But there's a great article that surfaced this week by Stephen Levy, or Levy. I never know if you say it Levy or Levy. Stephen Levy, where he sat down to talk with Apple's executives about their machine learning and AI efforts. And yes, Apple has been using machine learning for years in their in many areas of their business. And there's great details about this in this piece. So it's well worth a read. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com. But you may or may not know, and I did not know this till I read this piece, that Apple moved Siri over to a neural net-based system in the U.S. on July 14th, 2014. They actually moved Siri to a neural net for the rest of the world on August 15th, so about a month later, 2014. And that's when Siri had some kind of big improvements in terms of how she responded, how she reacted, and the things that she could actually do for us. But it was kept quiet. It was kind of behind the scenes. Apple didn't really want to tip off any of their competitors, what they were up to. And so machine learning, deep learning, and AI are powering now most of Apple's latest technologies. And some of the benefits are already being felt, but I think a lot of these things you're going to see in the new technologies powering iOS 10 and Mac OS Sierra. It's going to take all of those experiences and push them forward even further. Right now, you can kind of see Apple's machine learning efforts in things like app suggestions, the quick type predictions that you see in the Apple iOS keyboard, caller ID that knows people who are not in your contact list because it's actually gleaned that from maybe email signatures or other information that it finds in your emails or other parts of the system. And all of this stuff, all of this data and this information is something that Apple is calling the Apple Brain. And because of Apple's fierce protection of privacy, what's really cool about all this stuff about the Apple Brain is that it actually lives on your device. It sits on your iPhone or your iPad locally. It's not up in the cloud. It's not something that Apple has access to. And amazingly, Apple says that the entire Apple Brain for most people on their device takes up just about 200 megabytes of storage space. And while that may seem small, it actually contains a lot of valuable critical information that the machine learning system and the artificial intelligence can use to do really helpful things for you. One of the ways they kind of keep it small is that they're actually deleting older data, which is another kind of security protection feature. So it's not an infinite amount of data. It's not going back forever and ever. It's just more recent, relevant data to, you know, that the system needs to do what it does. And so Apple kind of detailed some of the ways they use this technology. And there's ways that you're going to kind of see as a user, and there's other things that they do that they don't. So just a few examples of this is, you know, something that tells the Apple Watch when you're actually exercising or not. They use machine learning to kind of figure out, you know, what is exercise for you, what is not exercise for you. And that's all built into the algorithms and into the logic. Palm rejection on the Apple Pencil actually uses machine learning to help identify what is your palm and what is not. Machine learning helps them identify the contents of your photos. This is going to become really evident in iOS 10 and Mac OS Sierra, the updates to the photo applications. And I can tell you right now, it is amazing how you can find photos and search for photos by the content that's in them. And this isn't metadata that you've added. This isn't tags that you've put in there. Actually, on the device, it's going to process through your photos, keeping all the data locally, and add all kinds of information. So if you want to see photos that have palm trees in them, you can simply ask Siri to find those for you, and she will find every photo in your photo library that has a palm tree in it and do it pretty accurately. I've been amazed so far at what a great job that system does. And that's all enabled by Apple's machine learning efforts. They use machine learning to determine when to hand off a weak Wi-Fi signal over to cellular data. And they use machine learning to help keep features like Hey Siri or Always On Siri from eating all of your battery life. And I can tell you, in iOS 10, that Siri, to me, seems to be dramatically improved. She's much more responsive. She's much more intelligent. She's able to do a lot more things for me. And I think that's all enabled by this technology, this machine learning and deep knowledge that Apple has been working on for years. And if you're wondering, well, how is this any different than sort of what Google and Amazon and others are doing? They kind of focus on this in the article, and I think this is a really valid point, is that we've already talked about the privacy, you know, keeping your data local and private and not sort of exposing that to the servers and to advertisers and stuff like that. I think that's a huge thing, a huge advantage that's in Apple's court. But the other thing that Apple has is they have the advantage of being able to tweak not only the software systems, but also the hardware. So they can do things like the engineers who are working on machine learning, or the scientists rather, they can go and talk to the chip designers, and they can work things specifically into the A-series chips and design features and benefits that are set to optimize the machine learning and the artificial intelligence. Apple can also control the hardware design, things like the positions and the quality of things like microphones, for better user experiences, better background noise rejection, better interaction with Siri and the artificial intelligence to make it feel more natural. And that's just something that other companies can't do. They're having to build the software system for artificial intelligence and machine learning, but it's going on all sorts of different kinds of devices, on different kinds of processors, things that are optimized in some ways, you know, where some devices will be optimized, some won't. And that detracts from the overall experience. And really, I think the power of having displayless interfaces or voice-first interfaces is going to be the fact that it feels natural. It feels like you're having a conversation with a real human being, and the system's reacting in ways that you would expect, and you're able to interact with it without having to use set commands or sort of learn a language that you have to use specifically to talk to this assistant. So, you know, Apple is better positioned, I think, because of the hardware and software integration to actually create those experiences. And just culturally as a company, I think that's in their DNA. That's what they focus on. They focus on that end consumer experience. It's not just about creating really cool technology and deploying it. It's actually about the overall experience that they're going to be focused on. Now, as far as the mic positions and the hardware, there's another report out there that is saying that microphone technology has been kind of become stagnant, and that's actually hindering Siri's performance a little bit. So if that really is the case, it'd be nice to see Apple focusing on some of their own microphone technology to make that part of the system better, because I do see that sometimes as a problem for Siri, even as I'm using it now. Although I'll tell you again, some of the problems I've been having with Siri, specifically in the car, I have a pretty noisy cabin in my car, and especially where I've mounted my iPhone, it's sort of right by an air conditioning vent. So in the summertime, when I'm running the air conditioning, very often Siri won't respond to my always on Siri commands. And I think that's because of some of the background noise, although that has seemed to have gotten better with iOS 10 for me. So I don't know what Apple has done, but maybe they've tweaked something in the software. And so maybe it isn't just the microphones that are a problem. But getting back to the artificial intelligence and machine learning conversation, you know, Apple has been acquiring AI, virtual reality, augmented reality, and machine learning companies like crazy lately. They've been scooping them up left and right, and whether you've been noticing it or not. But this month, they also bought a machine learning company or platform called Turi for an estimated $200 million. And there was a report out this week that Apple is now purportedly growing the Turi team to serve as their new machine learning division. And they're focusing on integrating the technology into new and existing products. Now, this report seems a little odd given the Levy piece, because Apple's already integrating this technology into their products and services. They've been doing it for a long time. They mentioned in the piece having people available to their various teams who want to tap into the machine learning technologies. They're available, they're integrated with these teams already. So why they would be taking the Turi team and sort of expanding it to create a division, it doesn't seem like machine learning within Apple currently is set up that way. It's not this sort of separate division. They're people who are integrated and inserted within the various teams that can use the technology. So maybe that's a little bit of a change that's going on, and that's what we're hearing about. But I think more likely Apple's just continuing to grow this part of the company by adding more staff and adding more people, because I think they see it as integral to the future of Apple's products across all of their various lines, both new and existing. So in case you've been thinking Apple's been stagnant in this area and that Amazon and Google are way ahead, go read the Stephen Levy piece, and I think it'll waylay any of your fears. I certainly feel like Apple has got the right focus in this area, and I'm ready to be blown away and impressed by all of the stuff they bring out in the future related to this technology. All right, this is a little bit ominous. Does your iPhone have touch disease, or is it going to get touch disease? And you might be going, Adam, what is touch disease? Well, iFixit is reporting a symptom that's being noticed by a growing number of iPhone 6 and 6 Plus owners. And what's happening is impacted users are experiencing unresponsive touch screens that show a flickering gray bar at the top of the display. And that's sort of how touch disease starts. And then it's reported that over time, the touch screen will eventually stop working completely. Sounds pretty bad, huh? And the reason we're hearing about this now and why this is coming up is there's one shop that's been doing a lot of repairs, a company called iPad Rehab, and they say that they are now getting up to 100 iPhone 6 and 6 Pluses a month that are not responding well to touch. And when they started looking into why is this happening, what's going on with these models, what's the cause, and why is it only the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, they found some really interesting stuff. What's going on is the problem occurs with the touch IC chips, and these are integrated circuits that translate your touches on the touchscreen to the processor. It's kind of the intermediary for the touchscreen and the CPU. And so at first, a lot of people thought it was a problem with the actual touch panels or the displays, but it turns out that it's these controller chips, because the controller chips connect to the logic board through an array of these little tiny micro solder balls. And because the new larger size iPhone, the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, has a little bit of flex, you remember bend gate? This isn't a bend gate thing, but the reality is the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, they do bend a little bit, they flex. So if you're the type of person that puts them, say, in your back pocket and sits down, flexes a little bit, and that flexing is apparently causing the solder points and these little micro solder balls to pop and crack. And if you couple that with dropping and rough handling, it increases the likelihood that these solder joints are going to fail. And when they fail, that's when you start having display problems. Interestingly enough, one of the quote unquote workarounds or fixes is if you apply pressure to the area where the IC chips are, you can kind of get touch responsiveness back. Obviously, that's not a good solution, but it sort of gives you an example of what the problem is. It's like these broken solder joints. I had actually a 14-inch MacBook back in the day that suffered from the same kind of issue, where the GPU would eventually, through heat and through other things, have its solder points break, and then the video fails. And that seems to be what's going on in this case. And why it seems to be happening only on the iPhone 6 series is because prior to that, Apple actually added to these solder areas a blob of this cured underfill stuff that would kind of hold the chip in place and secure those little solder ball joints. They also added a rigid metal EMI shield that would cover the Touch ID chip, or Touch IC chips rather, and that seemed to provide some extra support to kind of prevent some of the flexing that would happen. And if you're wondering then, well, why does the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus seem to be immune from touch disease? Well, that's because Apple actually moved the Touch IC chips off of the logic board with those models and onto the display assembly. So that seems to be protecting these a little bit more. So what do you do if you're noticing that your iPhone 6 or 6 Plus is suffering from touch disease? If you start to see this problem where the touch screen is becoming unresponsive and then suddenly you see this gray bar at the top, what are you supposed to do? Well, you kind of have three options. If you're still under your AppleCare warranty, then you probably want to get it into Apple report the issue, and they will likely just replace your phone. If you're not under warranty, replacing your phone could be pretty expensive, right? The other option would be to replace the logic board. So go into the Genius Bar, have them replace the logic board, or go into your Apple Authorized Repair Center, replace the logic board. Well, that can be expensive. And replacing the phone and replacing the logic board isn't really going to solve the problem. Yeah, you're going to have a new unit, but the problem, the underlying problem, still exists. So probably the best course of action would be to get the IC chips replaced and have new ones soldered on. Now, not many places do this kind of work, but iPad Rehab is one of the places maybe you could go to do it. The other thing that iPad Rehab is doing, in addition to just replacing the chips and putting in new solder, is they're also adding a metal shield, like in the old design, over the top of those new chips to try and provide some internal reinforcement. They don't have enough data on ones that they've repaired so far with the new metal shielding, but so far they've said they haven't heard of any issues with repaired phones that they've sent out that has that fix in it. So how you would find a local place to kind of do that repair, I don't know. But one thing you want to make sure that they do is they actually replace the IC chips. They don't just reflow the solder. Because there is a technique where you can kind of reheat the solder and get it to kind of reattach, but that only weakens the solder a little bit more, and eventually you're going to suffer from the same issue. It's just kind of like replacing the logic board. You've just given yourself more time. Eventually, the problem is probably going to crop up again. So, like I said, if you're under warranty, have Apple replace it, but likely it could still develop touch disease, over time. And in case you're wondering, yes, there's already a class action lawsuit being filed over this. And that was to be expected. I didn't expect this report to come out and to people not to file a class action over this. I don't think that's really necessary. I think Apple is ultimately going to handle this. Like I said, they're repairing it under warranty. And I would say, even if you aren't under warranty, you might want to call the Genius Bar. You might want to contact Apple and see if they'll do anything for you anyway. You may be surprised by the results. That's probably the quickest way to get your iPhone fixed or repaired. But other than that, find a place that can actually perform the fix for you. But man, touch disease does not sound like a fun thing. And I guess I'm glad I replaced my iPhone 6 Plus this last go around. And then finally in the news for this week, if you're running iOS 9.3.4, you probably want to upgrade. Apple released iOS 9.3.5. It patches a critical zero-day exploit vulnerability that has actually surfaced in the wild. Now, you're probably not going to get hit by this, but this came via a report by Citizen Lab and Lookout Security. They claimed that some governments were actually already using this zero-day exploit to target activists and dissidents. And that's because this exploit allows an attacker to access your device's camera, microphone. They can capture audio calls. They can even bypass encryption on end-to-end secured apps like WhatsApp or messages. So they can intercept your messages. They can do all kinds of things. It's basically designed to do surveillance on someone's iPhone. Now, again, most users are not likely to be impacted by this, but running the update is probably still worth it. So Apple continues to be extremely focused on maintaining their customers' security and privacy, and this really makes a step towards continuing to protect that. But also somewhat related to protecting your security is that Apple recently had a patent application that surfaced that shows they're looking into more proactive anti-theft measures potentially for the iPhone. It shows an invention that describes collecting fingerprint and photo data of a thief when they attempt to access a stolen iPhone, and that could potentially help track down iPhone thieves. They also say it could potentially capture video and audio of the environment that the Thief's In. And I know that sometimes, depending on upon how the audio is, audio can help actually identify locations of where people might be. So I think this kind of update would be a cool addition to Find My iPhone. You know, if you can actually get a photo of the thief, capture his fingerprint, this is all stuff that you could maybe take and turn over to law enforcement for them to actually track down criminals. So I'd like to see this actually, you know, put into a future iPhone. As goes with a lot of patents, a lot of times this technology is stuff that gets patented but never actually makes its way into an actual product. But this is one that seems pretty useful and seems like it wouldn't be that hard to implement. So who knows, maybe we'll see that in a future update. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is MacPaw. Right now, MacPaw is offering an awesome back-to-school bundle on two of their very best apps, Clean My Mac 3 and Gemini 2. They're doing it at a great price. You can check that out at macpaw.com/maccast. And I can tell you that I use both of these applications to actually keep my Mac lean and clean. They are both designed for cleaning up your Mac and also doing maintenance. Gemini 2 is really focused on deduplicating, finding duplicate files all over your Mac. You can look for duplicate copies of photos, music, files, and it helps you safely and easily remove and eliminate those duplicates. You can also, you know, find things that maybe you want to archive and back up, get cleaned off of your Mac, get rid of those duplicates. You know, we all kind of end up with this over time. You're using your Mac, you accidentally put one file here, one file there, it's the same file. Do you really need two copies of that? Photos is a place where that often becomes a problem, and you can use Gemini 2 to actually clean that stuff up. Clean My Mac is a critical tool for me. I use this probably on a monthly basis at the very least, if not more frequently, and it does all kinds of house cleaning. It can actually help you find junk in photos, in iTunes, in your system folders. It can clean out that stuff, old cache files, those sorts of things. It can help you remove old mail attachments that you don't need anymore. So it can really free up a lot of space on your hard drive. It has utilities for finding and removing old and large files that might be on your Mac. So you can find those old large project files, those iMovie project files, get those archived and moved off. You don't need those locally on your system forever. Can help you identify those things. Also can help you find and completely remove old applications that you're no longer using. It has an uninstall feature, so it goes in and finds all those little bits that are in the application support folder, in the preferences folder, so you're not just deleting the app and leaving all that stuff behind. You can actually clean out all of that stuff. And best of all, something that I love about all of MacPaw's applications is that they're designed for the Mac. They look great. They have a great user interface. They're easy to use. Makes it easy to review things before you take any action, so you're not accidentally deleting or removing something that really isn't a duplicate. And it just helps me keep my Mac tidy and free up space. So you can get a great deal on both of these apps just in time for back to school. Get your machine cleaned off. Get ready to go back to school. Head to macpaw.com/maccast. And while you're there, be sure to check out all of MacPaw's other great applications as well. And a big thank you to MacPaw for their support of the MacCast. Now, the first thing I have to follow up this week on is a quote that I totally mutilated on the last episode of the MacCast. Steve Jobs was classically famous for using a quote from Wayne Gretzky, and I have to apologize to both Gretzky and Steve for completely mutilating the concept of the quote. The quote actually is, "I skate to where the puck is going to be, not where it has been." And what we were talking about is Apple not being a company that's focused on the past. Apple is focused on skating to where the puck is going to be, getting to the place where they are going to be in the future. And I totally messed it up. I think I said something that implied that Apple was constantly skating to where the puck had been, which would be looking to the past, which is something that Apple doesn't do. So thanks to all of you who sent in your comments to let me know that I had totally messed that up. And hopefully now I've clarified that and we're on the right track. I skate to where the puck is going to be, not where it has been. Apple is skating to where the puck is going to be. Another thing that came up on the last episode of the MacCast was I asked you, hey, if Apple is going to put out new products, new Macs specifically, what kinds of things would you want to see in an updated Mac? And I got a lot of great feedback from you that I wanted to share. First, Andrew wrote in and he said he's now excited about the prospect of Apple actually putting out updated iMacs because unfortunately, his mid-2011 27-inch iMac just died. He had a failed video card. It was part of Apple's warranty extension program for the failed AMD Radeon HD 6970M video card, but that only covered the card for a failure period of 4 years past the original date of sale. Since that's a mid-2011 model and it's now 2016, it wasn't covered. And Andrew, I was really sorry to hear about that. I'm glad you're excited about some potential new iMacs, and it sounds like there's going to be some new ones here, probably in October. But I just wanted to comment on that failed video card thing. You know, we talked about, it seems like Apple's now having failed video cards or Touch IC controllers that affect video in iOS devices now. But overall in Macs, I just have to say, they seem to have a lot of problems with third-party graphics cards. And I don't know what that's all about. The integrated ones don't seem to have any problem. It's those third-party ones that are on the motherboard, things like the AMD processors that seem to be failing left and right. And most commonly, it does seem to be a problem with the solder and the solder breaking. It's the issue that's been with the 2011 MacBook Pros. It was the 2010 MacBook Pros. It's sounding like the iMacs had this issue as well. So if I were Apple, I'd be focusing a little bit more on what's causing this problem. I guess some of the newer models haven't suffered as much from this issue. I've heard some reports of it happening occasionally. So maybe they did figure this out. Maybe it was just 2011 was kind of the really bad year for GPUs and failed graphics cards. But yeah, you should have some great new iMacs coming up here in the next month or two. Diego wrote in to say that he wants Apple to make the equivalent of an HP Z840 workstation. And Diego, I have to be honest, I didn't know what that was. I actually had to go look it up online. But basically, it's a tower. It's a tower workstation. Something with PCI slots for expandability is what Diego said. I want to be able to upgrade. And before anyone writes in to kind of email bash Diego, remember, I said to write in about what you want, not what you think Apple is going to deliver. So this is basically Diego's wish list. And Diego, I think basically you want the cheese grater Mac Pro back. You want that big case where you can drop in a bunch of hard drives and a bunch of PCI cards. And I think there's a lot of pro customers who want exactly the same thing. So I don't think you're alone, but I hate to say it, I think Apple went lactose intolerant starting with the new Mac Pro, the trash can Mac Pro, and I don't see them going back. I don't think they're going back in that direction. And I'm not even holding that much hope that they're actually going to update the Mac Pro in its current form factor. But assuming they do, I think your best possibility for PCI expandability on the Mac is going to be a PCI expansion chassis using Thunderbolt. Right now, you can get those for Thunderbolt 2. Hopefully, in the future, they're going to be adding Thunderbolt 3 support. And there's a lot of options out there for PCI expansion chassis, and that's going to be the way to go. Yeah, not as elegant as kind of having it all in one big case. You know, I was a big fan of the cheese grater Mac Pro. I think it was one of the best Macs that Apple ever made, and a lot of people are in that same camp. I never personally owned one, but I always admired and loved them. It was a little bit too much horsepower for a lot of the things that I did. And I think for Apple, that's kind of where things are. You know, there's a small percentage of consumers that the Mac Pro really serves. And there's a much larger percentage that say something like the 27-inch Retina iMac serves. And Apple seems to be a little more focused on the consumer these days. On the iPad side of things, they're more focused on enterprise and government, as well as education. And for the pros, yeah, I have a feeling Apple is abandoning that market. Like it or not, and I know a lot of people don't like it, I think that's sort of where we're headed. So I wouldn't expect a HP Z840 workstation style Mac from Apple anytime soon. I don't get the impression that you did either, but you know, I think, again, a lot of people have that same wish. And then I also received this comment from Cindy about what she might want to see in a potential update to Apple Watch.
Hi, Adam. This is Cindy from Pennsylvania. In a recent episode, you asked listeners to talk about their experience or their hopes for a Watch 2. Well, I'm calling to let you know that I just recently purchased a Fitbit Blaze health exercise watch instead of an Apple Watch. The reason I went with the Fitbit Blaze is basically for three main reasons. The Apple Watch has the health app, but the user interface on the iPhone is terrible. And the health app that's on the iPhone cannot be downloaded to an iPad. So you have to view all of your health information only on the iPhone. With the Fitbit, they have a great Fitbit app that works on all devices. I can see my information on my iPad and my iPhone and on my computer. And it's a very clean user interface. It's not cluttered at all. It's called the dashboard. I really like that because I can see on one screen very clearly how I've done that day with exercise, with my heart rate, and with my steps, etc. The second thing that's really important to me is the battery life. While I don't have an Apple Watch, I've heard that it must be charged daily. Most people charge it overnight. But with the Blaze, I can actually wear it at night, and then it keeps track of how well I slept, and it doesn't need to be charged as frequently. I can usually go 4 days without having to charge it. I get notifications on my Blaze, and I know the Apple Watch can do that. The apps on the Apple Watch are just too small. I'm over 50. My eyesight isn't great. I have to use cheaters. So I really wouldn't use the Apple Watch apps very often. And the biggest downfall, I guess, for the Fitbit Blaze is that it doesn't have Apple Pay. But I have my phone with me and I can pay with that. So for all those reasons, I decided to get a Fitbit Blaze, which cost me about $180 with tax in Pennsylvania. And I can watch my exercise routines and see how I'm losing weight all on my iPad on a nice big screen. I would be interested in Apple Watch because everything I own is Apple. And if they came out with a better battery life and they fix their user interface, then it would be more appealing to me. Also, I'm hoping that they come out with a medical records app so that I could store all of my test results and appointments, my blood type, that kind of information on an app by Apple that would be kept private. Thanks for all you do, Adam. Love your show.
Hey.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Cindy. Thank you for the feedback. Yeah, I want to just talk about this a little bit. The Fitbit looks really nice. I was not aware of the Fitbit Blaze, so I'm glad that you wrote in to tell, or sent in a voicemail, rather, to tell us about it. And I totally get your points about the health app data on the iPhone. It can be a little cumbersome and kind of, it's not ideal. I think Apple could do a little bit better job, especially giving you more of that, like you said, dashboard overview of what's going on with your health stuff. I think with the Apple Watch, they kind of feel like the activity rings and the activity app on the watch is the place to do that. And that works pretty well, but you know, your point again is well taken that on the Apple Watch screen, that can maybe be a little bit small for some people and a little bit hard to see. Now, WatchOS 3 is going to have the new activity faces on the Apple Watch. So we'll have to see if that makes a little bit of difference. The other complaint, I think, in terms of the Apple Watch being a fitness tracker that you didn't address directly, but I've heard complaints levied against it, is that accuracy in terms of specifically distance traveled needs to be improved. Hopefully, if the Apple Watch 2 does have an onboard GPS, that's going to fix that issue. What I never quite understood was, since you have the iPhone, which does have GPS, why isn't that data used and tracked against the distance data that is reported and recorded from the Apple Watch, and just sort of averaged or put together? And I don't know why Apple doesn't do that. But in defense of the Apple Watch, I have to say, you know, I overall like the Apple Watch, but for me, health data is not my only focus. So it sounds like for you, the health features were really priority number one. And I would say, you know, overall, the Apple Watch is good at it, but I don't think that, because it's not its only focus, I don't think that it is the best solution if that's your primary focus. Something like the Fitbit may be a little bit better. Again, it depends on the user as well. I know people who have the Apple Watch primarily for its health features and really love it for that. So I think, you know, mileage will vary depending upon the type of person you are. And obviously you've determined that something like the Fitbit works a little bit better for you. And it's great, I think, that we have alternate choices. I'm hoping, like you, that Apple continues to improve the Apple Watch. I hope they continue to improve the health features. And some of the things like improving the software, I think, would go a long way to doing that. And we'll have to see with iOS 10 if that makes much of a difference. But getting back to the Apple Watch and health not being the only focus, you mentioned not really needing or liking apps possibly on the watch because their size. For me, I use apps a lot on my Apple Watch. I use Fantastical for my calendar and for my scheduling. I use the Carrot Weather app for doing weather. And I also use Siri on my Apple Watch to respond to things like text notifications and even in some cases answer emails very briefly. And another feature that's coming in WatchOS 3 is the new Scribble functionality, which actually allows you to draw letters right on the Apple Watch screen so that you can compose emails or respond to text notifications. And I think that's going to get a lot better. Again, if you're suffering from eyesight issues, that may or may not work for you. But overall, I've been pretty impressed and happy with that feature. I will also occasionally check email on my Apple Watch using the Spark app by Readle. So for me, the Apple Watch has become a pretty valuable tool. I think with WatchOS 3, it's going to be a pretty big game changer for Apple Watch. So even if you don't have newer hardware, I think Apple Watch is going to be a lot more useful with faster applications and sort of more functionality, more focus on watch apps, I think is going to be good. And I think developers are going to respond to it and we're going to get better apps on the Apple Watch. So I think it's going to be good. To address your concerns over battery life, you are absolutely correct. For most people, the Apple Watch is a daily charger. I do know people who will sleep with it and do use sleep tracking applications for Apple Watch. The difference being that they generally charge in the morning. It doesn't take very long to charge the Apple Watch. So what they'll do is they'll keep it on, they'll sleep with it overnight, and then in the morning while they're getting ready, taking a shower, brushing their teeth and things like that, they'll just connect the Apple Watch to the charger. And within 30 minutes, it usually can get almost a full charge or get back up to 100%. So the battery's okay. I agree, it'd be great if it went a little bit longer. With Apple Watch 2, as I mentioned earlier, it's going to have a bigger battery, or it seems like it's going to have a bigger battery, but a lot of that extra battery may be taken up with some of the other features like GPS. So will it get a longer battery life overall? I wouldn't expect a whole lot of improvement. So it may not be a big enough update for you. You may be looking at waiting until Apple Watch 3 before it has the features that you want. But certainly, thanks for sending in kind of your comments and your wish list for Apple Watch, and thanks to everybody else for their comments on future Apple products. That was great. And I don't think we need to end it here. If you didn't get a chance to send something in, give us a comment, especially what are you looking forward to in new Macs, since we probably will see some of those in October. Maccast@gmail.com if you want to send in your comments. And I certainly welcome audio comments. I just ask if you can keep them brief. 2 to 3 minutes is usually a pretty good length. And I look forward to hearing from you. Neil has encountered an all too common problem and question that I get asked about when it comes to our iOS devices and specifically cellular data usage. And that is, you've been humming along, you've been using your iOS device, everything's going great, your data usage is consistent, and then suddenly something changes and your data usage goes up exponentially. And I'm talking about like a factor of X number of times more. So 2 times or maybe even 3 times more, suddenly cellular data has gone ballistic and you have no idea why. And you're going, I haven't changed my behavior. I'm doing all the same things that I've always done, listening to Apple Music, getting my text notifications. But now my cellular data provider is saying I'm using 3 times as much data. And this happened to Neil. He's like, I went from suddenly using, you know, one gigabyte to 3 gigabytes. And I tried to go in and figure out what was going on. And the question becomes, how do you track this data usage to try and figure out what app or what thing is the offending thing here? Who is the culprit on this? And Neil went down the right track. He said, you know, I went in, I checked in the settings under cellular, and that shows how much data usage for each app is being used, but I couldn't figure it out. And the trouble for a lot of people the first time you go in there is that you might not realize at first that what it is showing is all your data usage since the last time the data usage data on the device was reset. So you get in there and it's not apparent what caused that big uptick, because one, it hasn't been reset in a while. And the other thing is that the view is alphabetical by app, not by usage, and you can't resort it. It'd be nice if you could resort it by, you know, usage, so you could see your biggest offender is on top and then, you know, gradually getting smaller. But because the data is aggregated and not since a specific period of time, you can't just see, okay, in the past week, which app is using more data. And for the second part, Neil, I can actually fix your issue, because that date, that reset date, you can actually control. If you scroll to the bottom of the cellular data settings on your phone, you can actually see the last time it was reset. And it was funny because when you emailed me and I went and looked at this on my iPhone, I have not reset that data since September 25th, 2015. So it's been over a year. So just for an example on how I wouldn't be able to tell if my data usage had gone up significantly in the past month, I wouldn't be able to tell what was using data. For my system services, it showed that I had used 35.9 gigabytes of data, and that was since a year ago, and 30.8 gigabytes of that was personal hotspot. But when did I use that? I happen to know, because I used it a lot when I was camping and for streaming video, that it was probably back in July when I used the majority of that data. And Netflix was showing I used 3.3 gigabytes of data. Again, it was probably in June when I used that. Apple Music is showing that I used 6.3 gigabytes of data. Yes, I absolutely use and love Apple Music. Anytime I'm in the car, I'm streaming music over cellular data with Apple Music. So I don't find that number surprising. It sounds large. Actually, it seems smaller than I would have thought it would have been. So the key to this is resetting that start point, and then from that point forward, you can monitor to see how much cellular data each individual app is using up. So again, you're going to go into settings, you're going to go into cellular, you're going to scroll all the way to the bottom, and you're going to tap the button that says reset statistics. And it's right below where you can see the date that it was last reset. So you tap reset statistics, it's going to ask you to confirm that. You confirm, and now you'll be reset back at zero. And now from that point forward, you can come in here and you can see what each app is using. So I know people who will do this like at the first of every month. And that way you can track your data usage for each individual app over the month. When you come back into the cellular data settings, now when you're scrolling through the list, even though it's only alphabetical, at the very least, you can see under each application how much cellular data it's using. And so I hope that will help you out. Now, before we finish up here, I want to point out a few other things that you can do here in the cellular data settings. I already mentioned that below each app, it shows the total data that it's used since the last reset, so you can do that. You can also turn off an individual app's ability to use cellular data. So there's little toggle switches there. If you find an app that you're like, hey, that app doesn't need to use cellular data, I only use that when I'm on Wi-Fi, just toggle it off. And then that app will not be able to use cellular data without requesting permission or without you coming back and changing the setting back. System services, which is all of Apple's internal applications, they're at the bottom of the app. So make sure you scroll down and you can tap to drill into that to get a more detailed listing of the individual system things that are using up cellular data. That's where I found out how much data I used via personal hotspot, was in the system services section of the cellular data settings. And then finally, up there at the top, you can turn on or off data roaming. So if you're going out of country and you're worried about data roaming, you can make sure that you have that turned off in the cellular data settings. So just a few more things that you can do there, as well as just monitor your cellular data usage. And I hope these tips help you out. Now, the last thing that I have for you this week is my thing of the moment. I actually came across a really cool app in the App Store from the folks over at MyScript, and it's an app, I'm going to call it Nebo, N-E-B-O, Nebo, Nebo, Nebo. I'm going with Nebo. And I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But what's cool about this app is it's a note-taking app, but it lets you write and take notes and then gives you the option to convert your handwritten text into actual text. You can leave your note as handwritten if you want, and even handwritten notes, it makes searchable, which is really cool. But if you double tap on that text, it will actually convert it into text that you can then export, you can convert to HTML, or you can convert to PDF. And you can even go back in and edit the converted text by writing right on top of it, which is a really cool feature. There's also special notations that you can do to apply formatting and set headings. You can do bulleted lists. Not only that, it allows you to mix and match some other kinds of content. So you can add drawings, you can add charts, and it will convert those charts. If you draw a circle, it'll make a perfect circle. You can add text to that. You can add callouts and lines, and the lines will stay anchored between objects. So if you're drawing a flow chart, you can move parts of the chart around and the arrows will stay connected, those hand-drawn arrows, which is really cool. It works great with Apple Pencil, although you don't have to use Apple Pencil. And I already mentioned you can export as text, HTML, or PDF. And best of all, this application right now is free for a limited time, at least in the US App Store. I haven't checked all the international app stores, so don't get on my case if it's not free for you. But right now it's free. The app is called Nebo, N-E-B-O. It's from MyScript. And check it out. I think it's really cool. If you take a lot of notes on the iPad and you want to convert those notes to text, I think this is one of the best, most accurate applications that I've come across for doing it. And not only that, as you're writing handwriting, it will show you what it's going to convert the text to almost in real time. And if it gets a word wrong, if it doesn't recognize your handwriting, another thing you can do is tap on that word and it will pop up suggestions for alternates of what that word might be. So you can kind of correct it right there on the fly. So really cool app, Nebo by MyScript. Check it out. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with Text Expander for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their great applications at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle, you know, that new iPhone is right around the corner. You can go to gazelle.com. It's a fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets, and you can lock in a price on your current iPhone right now to get the best price from Gazelle, because every day you wait, it's going to get a little bit less. So if you want to resell your device, lock in your price now. I think that they lock for 30 days, maybe a little bit longer in the lead up to a new iPhone, and you can get a great price on your old gear. Gazelle.com, and a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Or if you prefer, you can leave a voicemail on Skype. My Skype username is TheMacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on social media on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you're on Google Plus, check out the Google Plus community at google.com/plusMacCast. And that's the plus symbol. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.